content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is George Douglas from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And this week we're reading from The Week magazine dated October 12th. 2012. As usual, we'll begin with the main story section of the Week magazine. Our first article today is entitled The Supreme Court's Fraught New Term. Here's what happened. The Supreme Court this past week began its 2012-2013 term wading into cases that may have major consequences for such divisive issues as affirmative action, gay marriage, and voting rights. The court reconvened amid intense curiosity about its internal dynamics and partisan allegiances, sparked by conservative Chief Justice John Roberts' surprise decision in June to join the court's liberal wing in upholding President Obama's health care law. Next week, the court will hear oral arguments on a challenge to the University of Texas's policy of taking race into consideration to ensure racial diversity in admissions. The justices may also take up several challenges to Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act, which forces states with a history of racial discrimination to seek federal consent before changing voting or election laws. Later in this term, the court is also likely to decide the constitutionality of the Defense of Marriage Act, a case with the potential to sweep away all prohibitions on same-sex marriage. Court watchers expect moderate Justice Anthony Kennedy to be the swing vote in many of these cases, though Roberts' vote to uphold Obamacare, reportedly motivated by a desire to preserve the court's credibility as a nonpartisan body, has raised questions as to whether he'll be less consistently conservative. That vote caused at least a temporary rift with other conservative justices. We all start with the conventional wisdom that Justice Kennedy is going to decide the close cases, said Paul Clement, the former U.S. Solicitor General who argued against the health care law. We've all been reminded that that's not always the case. Now here's what the editorials had to say. First up, the court will decide whether foreign nationals can sue foreign corporations in U.S. courts for human rights violations that occurred overseas, said the Wall Street Journal. Nigerian activists wished to sue Royal Dutch Petroleum in the U.S. for allegedly colluding with the Nigerian government to torture and kill protesters. Why is this in an American court? It's a nonsensical claim, and it'll be easy for the court to rule on this one. The court's rulings on affirmative action and the Voting Rights Act will be a far more revealing test, said the Los Angeles Times. Both cases rest on the naive assumption that racism and racial discrimination are ancient history, and that laws designed to protect Americans against them are now themselves discriminatory. Chief Justice Roberts suggested as much when he said in 2007 that the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discriminating on the basis of race. But African Americans remain underrepresented in most colleges, so conservative justices should exercise some judicial restraint. Now here's what the columnist said. In its last term, the Supreme Court was asked to rule on the limits of government power, said David Cole in nybooks.com. This term, the justices will focus on equality, deciding whether the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection of the law extends to the right to be married or to go to college. Gay marriage will be this year's most explosive case, said Ed Whelan in NationalReview.com, with appeals of DOMA, the Domestic Marriage Act, and California's Proposition 8 pending. There's a real danger that the liberals and a fifth justice will overrule the public and create a federal constitutional right to same-sex marriage. If that happens and gay marriage is suddenly legal everywhere, it will ignite a decades-long firestorm among social conservatives that will make Roe v. Wade appear minor by comparison. Don't expect this court to make a major turn to the left, said Lincoln Kaplan in NYTimes.com. Chief Justice Roberts is no centrist. His health care law vote was the only time he sided with the liberals in a 5-4 vote over 117 decisions. Legal analysts agree that the Roberts court is the most conservative since the anti-New Deal court of the 1930s. It won't take the conservative justices long to reassert their dominance, said Andrew Cohen in TheAtlantic.com. When it rules on the University of Texas case, the court will finish off once and for all the concept of affirmative action in academia. The next item from the main story section of the week this week, controversy over Benghazi attack. What happened? The Obama administration faced a barrage of criticism this past week over its shifting account of the deadly assault on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya. For more than a week after the September 11th raid, which killed Ambassador Christopher Stevens and three other Americans, Susan Rice, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and other administration officials characterized the attack as a spontaneous protest triggered by an obscure anti-Islam film. But U.S. intelligence agencies reportedly knew within 24 hours that the attack had been planned and now acknowledge that it was a deliberate and organized terrorist operation by al-Qaeda, aligned militants. Republican Representative Peter King said Rice should resign for misinforming the American people. Democratic Representative Steny Hoyer accused Republicans of using the tragedy to score points in the presidential election and said Rice has expressed the intelligence community's most current assessment at the time. Further damaging details emerged from the House Oversight Committee, which said administration officials had repeatedly turned down diplomats' requests for extra security in Benghazi, even as anti-Western violence increased in the city. According to a personal diary found by CNN, Stevens was worried about his own safety. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton had previously described security at the compound as robust, yet only 4 lightly armed Libyans and 5 American guards were on duty on September 11th. Now here's what the editorial said. It should have been clear right away that this was a terrorist attack, said the Wall Street Journal. The fighters stormed the building with rocket-propelled grenades and mortars, hardly the hallmarks of a spontaneous protest. So why did the White House lie? Asked Washington Examiner. Obviously, President Obama realized that telling the truth would shatter the illusion that the Islamic world is newly friendly to U.S. interests, thanks to his charm offensive in the Middle East. All sides need to stop playing politics, said the Washington Post. The administration was slow to attribute the attack to terrorists, but it's still not clear whether this was the work of al-Qaeda or a local Libyan militia. So let's refrain from loose talk and let the FBI and State Department investigate the raid. That might be a lot to ask this close to an election, but given the tragic loss of U.S. life in this case, it ought to be possible. Now here's what the columnist said. Only one person has played politics here, said Mona Charon in NationalReview.com, and that's Obama. The president's re-election campaign is partly based on the fantasy that Obama ended the Islamist threat against America by killing Osama bin Laden. But this brazen and successful attack against Americans in Libya undercut that narrative, leaving the president no choice but to dissemble. Obama must be held responsible, said Brett Stevens in the Wall Street Journal. When the diplomatic mission came under assault, his administration refused to send in U.S. troops out of fear of violating Libya's sovereignty. How pathetic. Benghazi was Obama's 3 a.m. call, and he flubbed it. Blaming Obama is simply unfair, said Aki Peretz in TheAtlantic.com. As a former CIA analyst during the Bush administration, I can tell you that confusion reigns in the first hours and days after an event like the embassy attack. The intelligence and the assumptions that flow from it often is contradictory, fragmented, or flat-out erroneous. The original White House statements are evidence not of a cover-up, but of the mundane workings of the intelligence community as it is attempting, however imperfectly, to keep up with fast-moving events. Still, something clearly went very wrong in Benghazi, said Walter Russell Mead in TheAmericanInterest.com. While it's true that we send diplomats abroad to engage, not to hide behind concrete walls, the surge in militant attacks in the city should have led the State Department to connect the dots and boost security. We'll have to wait for the outcome of the investigations, but this doesn't look any prettier the more of it we see, and it doesn't reinforce the image of calm competence that the administration was hoping to project as the election draws near. Now, from the main story section, we'll turn to the controversy of the week, the American dream. What went wrong? Anyone can get rich in America, said Mary Sanchez in the Kansas City Star. All you have to do is pick a rich daddy. Forbes magazine has released its annual list of the 400 wealthiest Americans, and though the editors touted the inclusion of Oprah Winfrey and a few other rags-to-riches billionaires as proof that the American dream is still very much alive, the rankings actually prove the opposite. A recent study found that only 35% of the Forbes 400 were raised poor or middle class. The rest were born on third base, inheriting their fortunes or starting their empires with a big head start from well-to-do families. Social mobility was once considered the heart of the American dream, said Ron Brownstein in National Journal. Every generation was expected to be a little more successful and prosperous than their parents. But today, a child born poor in a European nation has a far better chance of making it to the top than one born poor in the U.S. 2/3 of American children born to the lowest earning 20% of parents will stay stuck in the bottom 40% of all their lives. The rich, meanwhile, keep getting richer, said Joe Nocera in the New York Times. While the median household income dropped by 4% last year, the cumulative wealth of the Forbes 400 increased by a whopping $200 billion. One reason for this growing disparity is that the wealthy invariably move their millions into investments, which are taxed at the low 15% capital gains rate. That's because the rich effectively write the tax code, said Les Leopold in Salon.com. The wealthier they get, the more money they spend on political lobbying and donations, which buys them yet more tax breaks, loopholes, bailouts, and financial deregulation, thus enabling them to amass even more wealth. Meanwhile, the middle class continues its slow decline. The real problem is our failing education system, said Laura Tyson in NYTimes.com. A college degree has never been more important for those who want to climb the income ladder. A college graduate today earns at least 75% more than someone with only a high school diploma. But as the gulf between rich and poor widens, children who grow up in poverty, amid dysfunctional adults, struggling schools, crime, and social chaos, simply can't compete academically with kids from the affluent side of town. We're perilously close to creating a permanent underclass for whom the American dream is a cruel lie. Perhaps it always was, said Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post. There's nothing wrong with optimism about the future, but the dream backfires when government tries to guarantee that every American will live better than their parents and achieve personal fulfillment. The belief that everyone should own homes, for example, led the government to pressure and incentivize banks to give mortgages to millions of people who couldn't afford them. The resulting housing bubble burst in 2008, nearly wrecking our economy. The belief that everyone should go to college led millions of students to take on huge debt for educations they didn't complete or that didn't lead to promised jobs. There's a sobering lesson here. In the real world, not everyone can succeed, and the future isn't always better than the past. It's time to retire the American dream, for it has become an act of collective self-deception. Now we'll turn to the popular column called Good Week For and Bad Week For in the Week magazine. It was a good week for shaving your head, after a new University of Pennsylvania study found that men with fully hairless domes are perceived as more dominant, stronger, and taller than other men. It was a good week for The Onion, after the satirical newspaper's story headlined Gallup poll, Rural Whites Prefer Ahmadinejad to Obama, was run as a factual story by Iran's Fars news agency. Fars later admitted it had been fooled, but insisted that it was true that most Americans prefer the Iranian president to President Obama. And it was a good week for the 1%, who are also the 47%, after the Congressional Research Service found that 2,362 people legally collected unemployment benefits in 2009, despite living in households with incomes of $1 million or more. It was a bad week for trying to improve on nature, after the German grocery chain Billa was widely ridiculed for selling pre-peeled, cellophane-wrapped bananas. If there is an easy-to-open, ready-packaged food, it's the banana, said a spokesman for Greenpeace. It was a bad week for Greece's reputation for competence, after a child's runaway helium balloon caused a power failure in Athens, shutting down the country's main flight information radar system. And it was a bad week for ordering the chicken, after the Red Flower Chinese restaurant in Williamsburg, Kentucky, was shut down for allegedly serving roadkill. Environmental Health Inspector Paul Lawson said it was the craziest thing he'd ever seen. They didn't know that they weren't allowed to, said Lawson. Now we'll turn to the briefing from the Week magazine this week. The briefing article today is entitled, In Gold We Trust. Some Tea Party activists are calling for a return to the gold standard. How would this affect the economy? What is the gold standard? It's a monetary system that directly links a currency's value to that of gold. A country on the gold standard cannot increase the amount of money in circulation without also increasing its gold reserves. Because the global gold supply grows only slowly, being on the gold standard would theoretically hold government overspending and inflation in check. No country currently backs its currency with gold, but many have in the past, including the U.S. For half a century, beginning in 1879, Americans could trade in $20.67 for an ounce of gold. The country effectively abandoned the gold standard in 1933 and completely severed the link between the dollar and gold in 1971. The U.S. now has a fiat money system, meaning the dollar's value is not linked to any specific asset. Why did the U.S. abandon the gold standard? Well, to help combat the Great Depression. Faced with mounting unemployment and spiraling deflation in the early 1930s, the U.S. government found it could do little to stimulate the economy. To deter people from cashing in deposits and depleting the gold supply, the U.S. and other governments had to keep interest rates high, but that made it too expensive for people and businesses to borrow. So in 1933, President Franklin D. Roosevelt cut the dollar's ties with the gold, allowing the government to pump money into the economy and lower interest rates. Most economists now agree that 90% of the reason why the U.S. got out of the Great Depression was the break with gold, said Liaquat Ahmad, author of the book Lords of Finance. The U.S. continued to allow foreign governments to exchange dollars for gold until 1971, when President Richard Nixon abruptly ended the practice to stop dollar-flush foreigners from sapping U.S. gold reserves. Why is gold in debate again? Libertarian Representative Ron Paul, a Republican from Texas, made a return to honest money a key plank of his presidential run, and the idea took hold among Tea Party conservatives, outraged over the Federal Reserve's loose monetary policies since the financial crisis. They argue that the U.S. debt now exceeds $16 trillion because the government has become too cavalier about borrowing and printing money. When the Fed prints money, gold standard advocates say, it cheapens the value of a dollar, promotes inflation, and effectively steals money from the citizenry. In a nod to those ideas, the Republican Party's 2012 platform calls for the creation of a commission to investigate setting a fixed value for the dollar. The gold standard forces the U.S. to live within its means, said investment strategist Mark Lucchini. Think of it as a person with a debit card rather than a credit card. The debit card holder can only spend what he has in the bank. What are the downsides? A fixed link between the dollar and gold would make the Fed powerless to fight recessions or put the brakes on an overheating economy. If you like the euro and how it's been working, you should love the gold standard, said economist Barry Eichengreen. Beleaguered Greece, for instance, cannot print more money or lower its interest rates because it's a member of a fixed currency union, the Eurozone. A gold standard would put the Fed in a similar predicament. Gold supplies are also unreliable. If miners went on strike or new gold discoveries suddenly stalled, economic growth could grind to a halt. If the output of goods and services grew faster than gold supplies, the Fed couldn't put more money into circulation to keep up, driving down wages and stifling investment. Could the gold standard come back? It's very unlikely. In a University of Chicago poll this year, not one of 40 top economists surveyed supported a return to gold. The last gold standard commission, established by President Ronald Reagan, voted by a wide margin against bringing it back. The size and complexity of the U.S. economy would also make the conversion extremely difficult. Just to back the dollars now in circulation and on deposit, about $2.7 trillion, with the approximately 261 million ounces of gold held by the U.S. government, gold prices would have to rise as high as $10,000 an ounce, up from about $1,780, causing huge inflation. It could do massive damage to the economy, said John Makin, an economist at the American Enterprise Institute. So why the clamor for its return? Nostalgia, said economist Charles Wyplos. People long for a simpler age when the U.S. was the dominant economy and there were no financial markets to speak of. It's like getting back together with that old girlfriend, said MarketWatch's David Widener. The current system may not be perfect, he says, but what people forget is that the gold standard never works. And the footnote from this particular article about the gold, in gold we trust, it's entitled Gold as Cold Cash. With the return of the gold standard a remote prospect at best, Tea Party activists are pushing for the next best thing, gold as an alternative currency. Last year, Utah became the first U.S. state since the Depression to make gold and silver coins legal tender again. If the federal government isn't going to do it, then we here in Utah ought to be able to establish a monetary system that would survive a crash, said Lowell Nelson of the libertarian group Campaign for Liberty. Metal coins can be exchanged for their market value, allowing someone, for example, to sell his car for 10 one-ounce gold coins, or roughly $17,800, said Rich Danker of the Conservative American Principles Project. more than a dozen other states, including Minnesota, Idaho, and Missouri, have recently considered similar laws. What the Federal Reserve is doing with our monetary policy is catastrophic, said State Representative Jason Spencer, who has co-sponsored a version of the coin bill in Georgia. Fiat currencies, if you study them through history, always end bad. Now it's time to read the best columns in the U.S. According to The Week magazine, our first column this week is entitled, When Every Day is Election Day. And it's written by John Fund in NationalReview.com. Perhaps you didn't realize it, but Election Day has already come, said John Fund. Voters in 30 states, including such critical battleground states as Ohio and Iowa, have already begun casting early and absentee votes, 6 weeks before November 6th. In the last presidential election, over a third of all votes cast their ballots early without showing up at polling places, and this year the total may reach 40%. Early voting, which used to be a last resort for people who couldn't get to the polls because of travel or illness, has now become a convenience, expanded by Congress and the courts in the mistaken belief that it increases voter turnout. This year, tens of millions of Americans will cast ballots without seeing the three debates or hearing each side's closing arguments. They may miss some scandal or unforeseen news event that could change their opinions of the candidates. Once a person casts an early vote, he can't take it back. It's like letting jurors render their verdict even before the trial is over. Should voters be able to vote whenever they feel like it? Is that what we really want? The next column is entitled, Why College Rankings Are Misleading, by Joe Nocera in the New York Times. It's the silly list that everyone cares about, said Joe Nocera. I'm referring to U.S. News & World Report's annual college rankings, which claim to use a rigorous methodology to create a list that has a huge and pernicious impact on college-bound students, parents, and higher education itself. The numerical rankings are imbued with an authority that is largely unjustified. Based on how much money a university raises and spends, its acceptance and rejection rates, and other arbitrary factors. Can you really say with any precision that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, number 6, is better than the California Institute of Technology, number 10? But since the rankings have a huge impact on prestige, applications, and revenue, colleges spend money like mad to move up the list, driving tuition costs past $50,000. Students afflicted with the status anxiety compete fiercely for admission to the most elite schools, instead of choosing schools that offer great value or are the best fit for them. Remember, where you go to college matters far less than what you put into college. It really doesn't matter whether it's number 19 or number 112. And the third column this week is entitled, Hate Speech Laws Are Hypocritical, by William Salatin in Slate.com. Jews have too much influence over U.S. foreign policy. Gay men are too promiscuous. Blacks commit too much crime. In much of the so-called free world, said William Salatin, I could be jailed for writing these sentences. Hate speech laws in most of Europe and in Canada forbid any expression of views that promote hatred or insult or defame religious or racial groups. These laws make it very hard to explain to the Islamic world why the West didn't censor the recent internet circulation of an anti-Islamic video. They are demanding to know why insulting the Prophet Muhammad is free speech, but vilifying Jews and denying the Holocaust isn't. Their confusion is understandable. How can free societies ban some kinds of speech and not others? In Europe, 4 Swedes were convicted of distributing leaflets denouncing homosexuality. A French man was convicted of publicly disputing the plausibility of Nazis killing Jews with poison gas technology. So why not a ban on any cartoon, video, or political diatribe that offends Muslims? If we're going to preach freedom of expression around the world, we have to practice it. We have to scrap our hate speech laws. Now we'll turn to health and science, that special section in the Week magazine. Our first article this week is entitled, A Breast Cancer Breakthrough. Breast cancer is actually four distinct diseases with their own genetic makeups, new research reveals, a finding that may lead to more effective treatment. Researchers examining tumors from 825 patients as part of the Cancer Genome Atlas project provided the first detailed analysis of genetic variations in the types of breast cancer, which kills 35,000 American women a year. One particularly deadly type was found to be more similar to ovarian cancer and some lung cancers than to other breast cancers. That raises the possibility that there may be a common cause to cancers found in different parts of the body, Mayo Clinic researcher James Engle tells the New York Times. The study pinpointed what researchers call the roots of four main types of breast cancer and suggests that these cancers should be classified and treated based on their distinctive genetic makeups rather than as one disease. Drugs that are effective against cancers elsewhere in the body could quickly be deployed to combat certain breast cancers, possibly within the next 5 years. This is the roadmap, says Washington University researcher Matthew Ellis, for how we might cure breast cancer in the future. The next article, Unix Health Secrets. New research has uncovered a surefire way to add up to 20 years to men's lives. Castrate them. When Korean researchers analyzed the genealogical records of males who were castrated as boys to serve in the palace of the Joseon dynasty between the late 14th and early 20th centuries, they found that the eunuchs lived between 14 and 19 years longer, on average, than their non-castrated peers. The records also showed that three of the 81 eunuchs lived to be 100, a rate about 130 times higher than that among people in developed countries today. The Atlantic.com reports, the findings support the idea that male sex hormones decrease the lifespan of men, the study authors write. In contrast to estrogen, which appears to enhance longevity, testosterone seems to weaken the immune system and increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. Lower levels of the male hormone may be a main reason why women tend to live longer than men and are 10 times as likely to reach the age of 110. The oldest galaxy. Astronomers have spotted the oldest and most distant galaxy yet found. The star system named MAX, M-A-C-S, 1149JD, is 13.2 billion light-years from Earth, and since it likely formed just 500 million years after the Big Bang, it could offer new insight into the universe's origins. We feel like archaeologists with a pre-Neanderthal fossil in hand, Johns Hopkins University astronomer Wei Zeng tells Space.com. Astronomers were only able to identify the tiny galaxy, which is just a hundredth the size of our galaxy, the Milky Way, because the gravity of galaxy clusters between it and our planet magnified its faint light, a phenomenon called gravitational lensing. The find supports the theory that an army of small galaxies helped transform the hydrogen gas cloud that made up the early universe in the wake of the Big Bang into the cosmos as we know it. So far, researchers have only been able to find one other galaxy that formed within 500 million years of the Big Bang. But the MAX 1149JD sighting suggests that a wider search for small ancient galaxies would yield many more examples. We are likely just seeing the tip of the iceberg, says University of Arizona astronomer Daniel Stark. The next article is entitled Help for Nervous Athletes. Want to improve your tennis game or your free throw percentage? It may be as simple as making a fist. German researchers have discovered that right-handed soccer players were far more likely to score a high-pressure penalty kick if they clenched their left hand just before they shot. It also improved the performance of judo experts and badminton players. That's likely because clenching the left hand activates the right side of the brain, which covers rote movements, which governs rote movements and dampens the activity of the brain's left hemisphere, which tends to initiate overthinking. Athletes usually perform better when they trust their bodies rather than thinking too much about their own actions or what their coaches told them during practice, sports psychologist Jürgen Beckmann of the Technical University of Munich tells ScienceDaily.com. By clenching their left hand, right-handed athletes were more likely to let their physical training take over, instead of falling prey to performance anxiety generated in the brain's left hemisphere. Lefties weren't tested, by the way. Researchers say clenching a left hand or foot could also help calm surgeons, musicians, and others who need to perform highly automated tasks under stress. And the final article from the Health and Science section this week, our health scare of the week, taking a bad bounce. Trampolines may seem like harmless fun and good exercise for kids, but a new report from the American Academy of Pediatrics warns that the bouncing mats are far too dangerous for use in the backyard. In 2009 alone, 98,000 people were injured and 3,100 hospitalized after trampoline accidents. Many of those accidents led to fractures and dislocations, and nearly one in five of them resulted in head and neck injuries, which carry the greatest risk of leading to catastrophic damage, such as paralysis and permanent brain damage. Pediatrician Susanna Briskin of Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland told Reuters.com. Children under the age of six accounted for roughly a third of the injuries, and since their heads are relatively large for their bodies, they are more likely to land on their heads than older children are, says pediatrician Ruth Borgen of Hackensack University Medical Center. Trampoline safety devices like nets and padding don't appear to reduce injury rates, nor does parental supervision. Jumping with friends is especially fraught. Some 75% of accidents happen when more than one person is bouncing. In that scenario, says Briskin, the biggest at-risk population is the smallest person on the trampoline. Now we will flip to the back of the week magazine for the last word. This week, the last word article is entitled, Why Do I Hunt? Alone in the wilderness, says Stephen Rinella, I find joy and purity as a human predator in search of food. At this moment, there are fewer hunters on Earth than at any other time in human history. Only about 5% of Americans hunt, down from about 7% a decade ago. For me, hunting is a form of resistance, an act of guerrilla warfare against the inevitable advance of time when hunting eventually disappears. When I'm asked why I hunt, I can answer best with hunting stories, and two come to mind. The first took place on a recent spring day when I was hunting turkeys in the Powder River Badlands of southeastern Montana with my brother Matt. Early that morning, we left Matt's pack llamas, Timmy and Haggy, tethered near our camp. Matt headed south, and I went into the next valley to the west. In the late morning, I started after a tom, or male turkey, that I'd heard gobbling several hundred yards away. I followed the bird for close to an hour, only once catching a glimpse of it. He was walking fast along the edge of a sandstone cliff, maybe about 30 yards above me and 200 yards out. I sat down amid a tangle of fallen timber and used a turkey call to mimic the soft clucks of a hen. Almost as soon as I did, the tom jumped off the cliff and took flight. He flapped his wings maybe 6 times and soared right over my head. Turkeys are not graceful flyers, nor are they graceful landers. This one crashed through the limbs of a ponderosa pine and then thudded to the ground on the timbered slope of a deep ravine off to my left. I turned my head in that direction and kept on clucking. I was hopeful that the tom would come back, but after a couple of minutes I hadn't seen or heard a thing. I called some more, but still no turkey appeared. And then something strange happened. Suddenly someone sighed very loudly just behind my right shoulder. I've had coyotes and bobcats come to my turkey call, but this sigh sounded like that of an annoyed person who was slightly out of breath from running up a hill. I turned my head quickly in its direction and noticed a large male black bear standing on its rear feet with its front feet propped up on a log that was leaning against the log that I was leaning against. I'm sure he was hoping to find a nest full of turkey eggs, and if everything went well, to catch the turkey too. Now he was staring at me with a very inquisitive look in his eye as he struggled to recalibrate his expectations. The bear interrupted my whirlwind of thoughts and fears with a woof, like the first noise a dog might make when someone knocks at the door. He then ran off through the timber at the casual pace of a jogging human. The sound of the bear's running died away, and the forest returned to its usual crisp and breezy stillness. I leaned back to wait for my pulse to slow and sat for maybe 5 minutes just breathing and thinking. How weird was it that this bear and I both happened to be hunting turkeys in the same place at the same time? I had that grateful and relieved feeling that you get when you first realize that you're recovering from the flu. Then I heard a turkey gobble, so far away and faint that the sound seemed more like a feeling than an actual noise. I got up to look at it, happy to be alive and walking in this wonderful and ancient world where bears sigh and turkeys gobble. Over 2,000 miles north of Montana, I was camped on the north slope of Alaska's Brooks Range, about 75 miles south of the Arctic Ocean's Beaufort Sea. I'd been there for a week, waiting for the arrival of caribou. I hadn't intended to stay so long, and I was running low on food. I dragged my canoe 9 miles upriver to this place, convinced that I'd find herds of caribou migrating through on their way toward the breeding and wintering grounds in and beyond the mountains to the south. So far, all I'd seen was a group of caribou cows and calves headed the opposite way toward the north. They didn't do me any good because all I could legally kill were bulls. I was allowed 2 of them, plenty of meat to get me through a year without having to buy any from a store. I hadn't taken a good look around that morning, so I walked up to the top of the small rise behind my camp. Stretching to the east and west was a braided and meandering valley, with its small tributaries and oxbow lakes, and gravel bars coated in felt-leaf willow and soapberry and loco weed. To the south, about 1.5 miles away, a long ridgeline paralleled the valley. I watched as 3 cows followed the same northbound route as the small band that had passed through a few days earlier. There was nothing to signify a trail or a path, and I wondered what was guiding them. I walked eastward 1/4 mile to look into their tracks. I wished that I could pull some kind of shaman's trick to understand where they were going and whether bulls were following them. But instead, the only thing the tracks revealed to me was my own sense of wonder. I started back toward the rise as a strange fog blew in from the coast. It came so thick and solid that it looked like it would scrape up my tent and carry it away. But then it began to break up into gauzy wisps that drifted over the land like bed sheets caught in the wind. Just as one of these sheets passed by, I looked to the right and watched as a herd of caribou came over the ridgeline and spilled toward me like a landslide of muscle draped in colors of brown and white and gray. Floating above this body was a tangled forest of antler. They were all bulls. They reached the river within seconds. If they'd kept coming in that same direction, they would have crossed the river and passed right next to me. But instead, they turned sharply to the right and ran upstream. I grabbed my rifle and pack and headed off as fast as possible, trying to parallel their route upstream. I ran until my lungs ached, without catching any glimpse of the animals ahead of me. I covered about a mile or so of tundra before I got to another piece of high ground. From up there, I could still see the bulls on the opposite side of the river. They had vanished. My initial impulse was to keep moving upstream, but then I noticed something about the contours of the land. Across the river, a slight gully led from the hills into the valley floor. It seemed to provide a good avenue of travel down from the high bank. A matching gully, just a little offset, cut down through the bank of my side. Between the gullies, the valley floor was not as thickly packed with willow as the rest of it was. I entered the gully and followed it down into the river valley. It terminated at a dry stream channel that was as wide as a driveway. I could see 100 yards in each direction, upstream and downstream, but only about 30 yards in the direction that I hoped the caribou would come from. I hid myself behind a clump of willows, laid out my backpack, and positioned the barrel of my rifle across the pack for support. Minutes passed, and nothing happened. Then more minutes passed, and still nothing happened. I got a sinking feeling in my gut. The river valley was only so wide, and the caribou had been moving fast. They should have come through already. I thought about racing upriver as a last-ditch effort, but it was too late for that. If they'd run that way, they were long gone by now. After another minute, I stood up to try to get a look across the tops of the willows, and then occurred the simple moment that I've been leading up to, the sort of moment that helps me to explain to people why I hunt. I was hungry in the wilderness, and here came a few tons worth of caribou, 50 yards out and closing fast. In a moment like that, there's no time for emotional dawdling. It's a time for unerring judgment. It's a time for speed, both mental and physical. It is a time for action and precision and discipline. It is a time to do what millions of years' worth of evolution built us to do. And in the act of doing it, you experience the unconfused purity of being a human predator, stripped of everything that is non-essential. In that moment of impending violence and death, you are gifted a beautiful glimpse of life. And that article was from The Meat Eater by Stephen Ranella, copyrighted 2012 and reprinted by permission by Spiegel & Grau, a division of Random House Publishing Group. Now from The Last Word, we'll turn to the Talking Point section of The Week magazine for this week of October 12th, 2012. The first article is entitled, "The Election. Is the Media Biased Against Romney?" If Mitt Romney loses the presidential election, said Mona Charon in NationalReview.com, it won't be hard to figure out why. The Republican presidential nominee has faced perhaps the most corrupt and tendentious coverage in presidential history, with the mainstream media doing everything in its power to ensure that its darling Barack Obama is reelected. Every gaffe Romney has made has been blown out of proportion, while Obama's many mistakes, horrible economic record, and mishandling of the attacks on Americans in Libya have been all but ignored by the supine press. As Paul Ryan, the vice presidential candidate, put it this week, most people in the mainstream media are left of center, and therefore they want a very left of center president. If you get your information from newspapers and TV networks, said Jay Nordlinger, also in NationalReview.com, you would never know Romney is an impressive man, successful in almost everything he's ever done, bright, warm, and decent. Instead, you would think he was a moron and a jerk. You've uncovered our grand plot, said David Carr in the New York Times. Each week, we in the mainstream media gather together in dark chambers to discuss how best to put our collective liberal thumb on the scale for President Obama. In the real world, such conspiracy theories make less sense than ever. Only 33% of people get their news solely from traditional sources, such as TV, public radio, and newspapers. So how can anyone claim there's a mainstream media at all? Across the new media landscape, there's a growing hegemony of conservative voices. Rush Limbaugh and a host of imitators dominate talk radio. Fox News is king of the cable news ratings. And the largest circulation newspaper in the U.S. is that bastion of conservative values, the Wall Street Journal. Online, there are hundreds of conservative blogs and websites. A more credible explanation of Romney's troubles so far is the obvious one. He's run a lousy campaign full of pratfalls. It's undeniably true that the Romney campaign is run very badly indeed, said Tim Stanley in telegraph.co.uk. But the media nonetheless overemphasizes and constantly repeats his mistakes while giving Obama a pass on his. Why? Not because reporters are left-wing radicals who only break away from their copies of Das Kapital to type up White House press releases. It's because the media has been seduced by Barack Obama's historic narrative as the first black president who rose from nowhere to take the White House in 2008. A defeat 4 years later would ruin that lovely story. Nowhere is this bias more apparent than in the media's fixation on polls, said Robert Stacy McCain in the American Spectator. This year, a preponderance of polls give Obama a sizable lead due to an unreliable skew in party identification toward Democrats. Every day, the media trumpets that Obama has a virtually insurmountable lead, demoralizing Republicans and convincing swing voters that the election is already decided. The poll coverage becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, creating a victory for Obama. Even though I loathe Mitt Romney, said John Cook in Gawker.com, I have to admit that conservatives have a point. The press has decided that Romney is a loser, a hapless robotic buffoon, and it filters every story through that perception. The media did the same thing to John Kerry in 2004, portraying him as a windsurfing, pussy-whipped flip-flopper, and to Al Gore in 2000, who was depicted as a sighing, disingenuous, wannabe alpha male. Unfortunately, this is how the political press covers elections as personality contests. Romney fell right into this trap by running such a cautious, uncreative campaign, said Ross Dutant in NYTimes.com. It was his job as the Republican candidate to shape the narrative and focus attention on Obama's record. He failed. And when his secretly videotaped dismissal of 47% of Americans emerged, Romney may have sealed his own fate. So even if the media is rooting against him, said Jason Riley in the Wall Street Journal, Romney and his surrogates should think twice about whining about media bias. If that worked, Newt Gingrich would be the nominee. The press was no less hostile toward George W. Bush and Ronald Reagan, and both Republicans managed not only to win the presidency, but get reelected. Romney is running against an incumbent with an 8.1% unemployment rate. If he loses, he has only one person to blame. And in a related article from the Talking Point section, Super PACs, not so influential after all. Our democracy may survive after all, said Neil King in the Wall Street Journal. In the run-up to this campaign season, earnest good government types warn that shadowy super PACs, made possible by the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling, would enable corporations and millionaires to buy the election with a tsunami of negative ads. But even after spending $250 million so far, these super PACs are looking less than super, with little evident impact on the election. Mitt Romney in particular was supposed to benefit from super PAC money, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. And indeed, pro-Romney super PACs like Karl Rove's American Crossroads have outspent pro-Obama super PACs by as much as 3-1 in some swing states. Yet Obama still leads in the polls. Democrats went into this election terrified that super PACs would give Republicans an overwhelming financial advantage. But that's one of the dogs that hasn't barked in this campaign. True, but this election isn't over, said Gavin Aronson in MotherJones.com. Despite an incoherent campaign, Romney trails by only 3 points nationally. Super PACs may have helped keep Romney in the game and will do their best in remaining weeks to flood the airwaves with attack ads. So far, though, Democrats have spent their money far more wisely, said Paul Blumenthal in HuffingtonPost.com. In critical swing states such as Ohio and Florida, President Obama's reelection campaign has actually outspent the Republican super PACs. Counting the efforts of both sides, campaigns, and super PACs, 7,083 pro-Obama ads ran in Ohio in September, compared with only 2,690 for Romney. Since Obama has jumped ahead in both Ohio and Florida, it suggests that money and political ads do matter. Now, with the last couple of minutes we have left in our program, a couple of short articles here. 1 in 5 female military veterans and 1 in 100 male ex-soldiers screens positive for military sexual trauma, according to the Veterans Affairs Department. The Pentagon estimates that 20,000 soldiers are raped by fellow soldiers every year, and Defense Secretary Leon Panetta calls sexual assault in the ranks a silent epidemic. Airstrikes on Iran's nuclear facilities could injure or kill more than 80,000 people, according to a recent study. The uranium conversion facility at Isfahan, for example, is located on the city's outskirts. Toxic plumes released from a strike would reach the center city within an hour, rapidly killing or injuring as many as 70,000 and exposing more than 300,000 to toxic clouds of radioactive uranium. And now we'll take a look at this poll watch for this week. 42% of American voters say pollsters manipulate their polls in favor of President Obama. 40% disagree, and 18% aren't sure. By a 71% to 13% margin, Republicans are more likely to say polls are skewed in favor of Obama. And a record-high 38% of Americans say they prefer the same political party controlling the presidency and Congress, while a record-low 23% say they prefer divided government. Democrats, 49%, are more likely than Republicans, 36%, or independents, 28%, to prefer one-party control. We have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm George Douglas. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week Magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast on our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.